Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Well, hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hello, good, Tay. How you doing?
Doing all right. Hey, do you have anything good to drink this week?
Well, we made some drinks. Most of the ones I made were for Mom. You know, she likes to hand me one of your coasters and say, "Would you make that for me?" Sure, I'll make it. But I'm getting pretty good at it. She's lucky that you have taught me what you have, because she's getting a much greater drink experience. And
God, I like that.
I've been enjoying the one that we created there that I can't talk about unless you're on the Patreon. I've been enjoying that one, the bespoke cocktail that I created. I liked it so much that's kind of my go-to, you know, for right now.
Well, and if you are on our Patreon, you're in for a treat. Two of you have cocktails coming out this week, so look out for that. Nice.
Yeah. What about you?
Oh man, nothing. Well, you know, kind of the same boat. Like, I feel like I made something for my choice that I was I really enjoyed. I was excited by, so I've made a few of those. Not anything I've consumed, but something that I've been on the hunt for is something I saw. I think it was on a TikTok. I've gone down that rabbit hole, but there's this like line of sodas that is like Pokemon themed, and I'm assuming they're from Japan, but there's one that is a salt and cheese flavored soda that I feel like has to be somewhere in New York. There are enough like Japanese supermarkets and Asian markets, it's gotta exist, but I saw a bunch of people try it and talk about how bad it is, but I need to try it. So that's been my drink sort of quest for the week.
Salt and cheese, huh?
Yeah, I don't. I was gonna say I'm vegan, so I probably shouldn't seek it out. But I don't think can't be cheese.
I like that. Everybody talk about how bad it is, so you got to try it. That's the same thing. People do this all the time. They take a drink of something or take a bite of something and say, "Oh God, this is terrible. Here, try it."
Oh yeah. Oh,
right. Why do you want to give somebody something that tastes terrible? That recommendation. Oh yeah, let me try that. Let me see how bad it is. Maybe I can puke.
You know, it's just the sheer curiosity of like salt water and cheese. I mean, there's elements there that sound okay, but as a drink, as a beverage, as a soda,
yeah,
fascinating.
It sounds like it'd be chunky. I wouldn't want a chunky drink.
Well, I'll keep you updated if I find it. I went to an Asian supermarket and like another place that usually has some weird stuff, and neither one had it. So we'll keep looking, but.
Well, good luck with your chunky cheese drink.
see if I can find it. Squirtle soda. But so for this week, I thought we could talk about, we had a question about it, and it's definitely something we've touched on here and there, but I thought we could sort of devote an entire episode to it this week, and that is garnishes.
That's right. Not to be confused with garnishments, where they take your wages to pay off a debt.
Yes. Although I guess there is some sort of root connection there. You know, I usually like to start with a sort of what is it segment whenever we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I feel like garnish feels pretty straightforward. We all understand the concept, but I mean, it's not just a bar term, it's a culinary term. But its origin, if you're interested, is Germanic, and it comes from a word meaning to fortify, equip, or warn. So it's got like some more nuanced mixed meanings in origin.
Hmm. It fortifies your drink and equips you with something to play with, and it warns you
of what's to come.
Yeah, warns you of what to come.
In some cases, I think in modern bartending, which we'll get to eventually, I do think a garnish can be a warning as far as what you're going to consume. But But of course, that equip is probably the meaning that we most are commonly referencing when we talk about why we garner something.
Yeah. You're equipping it with either a flavor or a smell for the most part.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that really is kind of it, because that is one thing about the concept, is it's surprisingly difficult to nail down the definition of a cocktail garnish in any precise way. I mean, when you look at the bevy of like roles a garnish can play, it is something that goes in or on top of or on the side of a drink that is not the drink itself. Meant to enhance in some type of way, usually visually, but not always. That's kind of it. And even that enhancement thing, I think, is even up for grabs these days, whether or not it enhances or not.
Now, one other thing I read that I found was fascinating, in some cases, it's to identify the beverage, because a lot of drinks, when mixed, would kind of look the same, but the garnish kind of identifies, usually each one has its own standard, so that kind of tells you what it is from another.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I feel like with the proliferation of craft cocktails, seeing like a brown drink in a rocks glass with an orange twist does not mean you're getting an old fashioned. There was probably a time period where you could count on that, but not so much anymore.
So there's a twist behind the twist, huh?
Yeah, outside of that, like we can't say that a garnish has to be edible, because that's not always the case. Like, like a cocktail umbrella. We can't necessarily say that it enhances the flavor of the drink. Some are just purely visual. And we can't even say it has to be visible or even solid, in some cases, just as much as, you could argue that salting a dish is garnishing it. It's the same with a cocktail. If you put some dots of bitter into it on top, or some scented oil I've seen sometimes, or foam or smoke, these are all, I think they fall into the garnish category, but they're things that aren't really as much solid or visible or tangible things you're putting on a drink.
Yeah, I had a smoked bourbon drink of all places at the Outback, and it was one of the best bourbon drinks I've ever had. And yeah. I mean, it was really good.
Well, a garnish can play not just an important role to the flavor palette. I'd argue that there's some cases where garnish is inseparable from recipe, like we talked about sidecars and crustas last week,
right?
And I would argue that sugar rim, which you could consider a garnish, when you make a brandy crusta or a sidecar, you sugar the rim of the glass. And if you've ever made one without the sugar rim, you might have experienced the same thing that I experienced. The drink's unbalanced. It's not sweet enough. It's too dry. You need that secondary sweetener. And in that case, it's just part of the recipe. It's essential to the enjoyment of the drink.
Yeah, I never had thought of that, but when I was reading the different types of garnishes, that's what a rim, when you rim your glass with something, that's a garnish.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes it's not, like, I've definitely had, like, oh, here's a spicy margarita. It's got some spicy salt on the side. You don't need it necessarily to enjoy the drink. It enhances it.
Right.
But when a garnish is part of the identity of the drink, I think it kind of gets into that gray area of garnish versus recipe. I even argue, like in the case of an old fashioned, I don't think you should make an old fashioned without a citrus peel. If you don't have citrus on hand, you're not making an old fashioned. The drink consists of three ingredients, four if you count ice. You need the peel. It's part of the recipe.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I when we made those margaritas for that one video, I like to drink my way around the rim so that I get a little salt in every sip, so I'll start out on one side, just start working my way around. I want a little salt in every drink. So.
Well, and I think, if you've made margaritas like with a salt rim, the action of usually the lime. Sometimes people use simple syrup, but to make the salt stick, you put it upside down in the salt, and when you flip it over, what happens?
A little of it goes in.
Yeah. So the salt gets incorporated into the drink itself, even if you're not, even if you're sipping from the part of the rim that you've desalted with your mouth, you're still getting salt in every sip. So it's a changing flavor, too. I mean, I think of the same of, like, when you put a cinnamon stick in a hot toddy, it doesn't just... It looks cute, of course, but as you're drinking that hot beverage, that cinnamon stick is slowly infusing into your drink. So it's right. an active drink. It's changing as you drink it. Mm-hmm. And I think, once again, blurring that line between garnish and recipe.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get too lost in the sauce of terminology, let's talk some history.
Go in the Wayback Machine.
Yeah. Like, where do we get this concept? And I mean, this is really, once again, it kind of depends on how you define garnish as to how far back you can trace it. Because really, I mean, if you go back to like the you know, we talked before about like the ancient Romans, one of the sort of stories of the origin of the word toast is you would serve your wine with toast. That would help neutralize the taste of like off wine. But you would also then eat the toast often. So you would have this element. And you see that even the British will like continue to do that with biscuits, like in their wine, to sweeten the wine, have like a little snack with it. And we're not talking cocktails in the sense of like a mixed drink, but it's still this idea of serving your alcohol with something that affects the flavor and improves it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, likewise, you know, we know that before we really get to single glass cocktails, which is brought about for lots of reasons, one of which is readily available, like ice machines. You know, we have punch as kind of a popular way of consuming alcohol. And a lot of early punch recipes we have will include peels or wheels in the punch, just sort of ambiently to infuse, but you can, as you serve it glass by glass, you can include one of those in the glass. So in that sense, mm-hmm. it is kind of a garnish there too.
Mm-hmm.
So garnishes really go back, as long as we've been drinking, the concept of something in there on the side, outside of just the liquid itself, isn't that far removed.
So a drink is sort of like a box of Cracker Jack. It's got a surprise inside.
Well, sure. I mean, you know. I don't think that, like, the decoder ring enhances the flavor of the Cracker Jacks, but, you know, we really, like, the advent of garnishes in the modern sense, prescribed to each cocktail individually as sort of theatrical element, really comes with that changeover from drinks being less medicinal and more social and more in bars and bartending, cocktailing becoming sort of an art form. And that is more late 1700s, early 1800s. You know, that's when you get garnishes. You get individual cocktails as elements that you can order. And then with those, you get that identifying thing, which you were talking about. And, mm-hmm. and they're largely edible at this time. You know, you get, like, the mint julep is a great example of this time period. You get that big frond of mint in a mint julep. It serves several purposes, right? First, it identifies mm-hmm. it. That's a mint julep. You got the cup, too. It's a pretty identifiable drink.
Yeah. But no missing that.
Yeah. But you've also got this big bouquet of mint. You've got the smell that's going to hit your nose as soon as you, mm-hmm. you know, get in there. And you also have that mint that's slowly dissipating into the drink as you drink it. So that is, you know, an early example of an iconic garnish that mm-hmm. becomes cemented with the drink. Cemented.
Cemented?
Well, I didn't even mean that.
That was a dad joke.
I know. It was accidental. Oh, no.
That was demented. That's what happens when you take the mint out.
All right. But you know, a lot of our reference for garnishes we can pull from recipe books at this time, and there's not like a whole lot. We're talking like Jerry Thomas's early books. He might reference it like a fancy version of a drink will include a lemon twist. Like it's still sort of, it's not necessarily as tied to the recipe as much as it is just sort of an accoutrement. It's really towards the end of the 1800s that we see more of an explosion of like a focus on garnishing, like that as an element of style and flavor. We talked about the maraschino cherry that was introduced in, like, the 1890s. The olive catches on not long after. The tiny onion. Yeah, that's where we really get these kind of important elements to a drink.
Now, I feel like when the cherries first started out, and they were, you know, the ones that were in the cherry liqueur, and they would come over, that those enhance the drink, because they're adding a certain amount of sweetness when they go in. Now I feel like that they're more just for looks, more so than actually enhancing the drink.
It depends on what cherry you're using. Because when we say maraschino cherry now, I think people immediately think of the bright red, toxic,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, artificial sugar cherry. maraschino, which, if you're curious about, you should listen to our episode on maraschino liqueur. Maraschino cherries are actually a very specific ingredient. They're very high end. They're pretty expensive, mm-hmm. and they absolutely affect your drink. They're very flavorful. They're also, they don't look like that. They're very dark red. You know, and that you're getting a lot, like you put a real maraschino cherry in your cocktail and it's going to add some flavor.
As opposed to just the typical cocktail cherry.
Which will still add flavor, but it's not necessarily good flavor. It's going to be that super artificial, like just sugar, fructose, you know.
Yeah, because during Prohibition, instead of being bathed in liqueur, they're bathed in a chemical to preserve them.
Right. Well, that's, yeah, the modern maraschino cherry is much maligned from the origin. You should seek out the original. But, you know, like, that fruit, the fruit elements also come into play around the same time period. I mean, this is sort of the era of the sherry cobbler, which I don't think we ever talked about cobbler specifically. I'm not talking about, like, a cobbler.
A pie.
No. It's a drink. It's a sherry drink. And it would be served just piled high with fruit. Which actually, once again, depending on your definition of a garnish, is responsible for not the fruit garnish necessarily, but actually, because it had all this ice and fruit on top of it, it became popular to serve it with a straw, so you could drink underneath all the garnish on top. And this was really the first cocktail to be associated with a straw. Nowadays, we take for granted that straws were ever unique or, you know, like original ideas, but the sherry cobbler helped popularize that.
Yeah, now they're destroying our ecology. All the straws, we can't have them anymore.
That's true. Well, you can get biodegradable straws or sugarcane straws. There are straws that are good for the environment.
Yeah. I hate the plastic ones. I hate the paper ones, though, because after about three sucks, they just suck. They disintegrate. They can't. It's like they collapse. Yeah, they don't suck. They don't suck. That's the problem.
I like the sugarcane ones. They have more structural integrity. I won't say who because it's a popular podcaster. But we were somewhere where we were offered sugarcane straws, and this person was like, "Oh, that means it's like candy, right?" And tried to bite into it real hard. It's not. It's just like it chews like plastic. It's just made of biodegradable sugarcane. they are better structurally. They're a little bit more expensive, which is why a lot of bars won't switch off to them, but I don't know. In any case, I guess you have sherry cobblers to blame. I guess the turtles
can
shake a finger at sherry cobblers.
That's right, you turtles.
sorry, turtles.
Turtles hate sherry cobblers.
if you're a friend of turtles, do not drink it. Yeah, plenty of straw alternatives. It's better to do them.
Just see the turtles. They're swimming in a circle in the pond, holding up signs with a red circle with a line through it over the sherry cobblers.
Look, it's not the sherry cobbler's fault. It's just the straw. but you know, of course, this is like we get the cherries and the Manhattans, the olives and martinis. These pre-prohibition days of cocktailing, most of the garnishes, and not all, which I'll get back to, not all. But most are edible garnishes that are essential flavor-building elements. They're sort of an element of the drink itself, if you will. Now, post-Prohibition, and especially with the advent of the tiki craze, we get into the realm of more fanciful as well as non-edible garnishes. This is where we get, you know, in terms of, like we get... grated spice is not new. We've had, like, grated nutmeg on top of punches since, you know, the 1600s. But this, you know, this paired with, like, pineapple fronds, like the pineapple leaves used to garnish a drink, or the flags that we've talked about, where, you know, you take, like, a lemon wheel and you put a cherry in the middle and you skewer all the way through it, so you get this little flag garnish. Even, like, fire, you know, you get, like, the little hollowed-out lemon or lime the half that's been juiced, and you fill it with 151 and you set it on fire. Things like this. Tiki really opens the door to just the most extravagant, like, overdone garnishes you can imagine.
Well, and then tiki opened the door to the umbrella. It opened the umbrella.
It opened the door and the umbrella, yeah.
Yeah.
the cocktail umbrella, which we talked about, you know, we talked about at some point. But just to sort of, you know, rehash it, there are a few different... Nobody knows exactly where the cocktail umbrella came about. It was in this, like, somewhere around the 1930s, 40s. They were in production around this time. They started being used in cocktails. Don Beach is sometimes offered up as the originator of it. There's another bartender by the name of Harry K. Yee, who was a Hawaiian bartender. And he definitely used them in his drinks. They both did. Yee was cool because he did a lot of innovative garnishing, actually. He used sugarcane sticks. He used orchids before that was popular. Nowadays, you see edible flowers a lot of times in cocktails, but he was using them back in, you know, the 50s. Maybe there are assumptions that maybe at some point Don Beach met Yee in Hawaii and, like, took some of his ideas.
Stole the idea.
Yeah. Don Beach was bartending in, like, the late 30s, so there's a bit of a time difference there, but it's hard to say when, you know.
Yeah.
Just because something becomes popular in the 50s doesn't mean this guy wasn't doing it for a decade before.
Right.
So.
Well, also, they also had the story that what led up to it was that he, like you say, that Harry Yee, he was putting the sugarcane stick in his drinks. Well, people would kind of chew on them, and they'd kind of dissolve, and they would pull them out of the drink. And the first place you'd have to stick it, because you can't just drop it on the floor, so they'd stick it in the ashtray, because, of course, everybody smoked in bars back in those days. So you stick it in the ashtray. Well, before you know it, the ashtrays are all gummed up with these sugarcane sticks. So he wanted to come up with something that wouldn't create that kind of problem, and so the umbrella is what he came up with.
Yeah. Well, and some people have argued that there was also, like, a functional element to the umbrella in its design, and this is... We've gotten scientists involved in this, I should say. Like, scientists have felt the need to come in and say, no, this is actually not true. But the idea that the umbrella was not just for looks, it's not a non-functional garnish, it actually cools your drink. So you're putting a little umbrella over your drink, and it'll keep it cool. Or it'll stop the alcohol from evaporating. Heat is ambient. If you're outside in the heat, the direct sunlight will melt the ice in your drink faster, but that little paper umbrella is not going to stop that.
Yeah. You're out in 90 degrees with a frozen pina colada. That umbrella is not going to make it last any longer. You better drink it faster. It's going to be soup.
Exactly. It's not working that way for you. In terms of functional versus non-functional garnishes, there's not a function to an umbrella. It's just cute.
Pina colada is another one with a big chunky garnish. Usually they put a big chunk of pineapple on the side of that, you know?
Well, that's, you know, that's fine. That's, you could argue that's, it's drawing on a flavor that's in the drink. So, you know, I mean, and that's a lot of, like, the early, the stuff that we've talked about, you, like the simple garnishes, like a lemon or lime wedge. That's offered up in, like, just, do you want to, it's like putting salt and pepper on your table at dinner. Do you want to add a little bit more citrus to your drink? You can do that. You know, your gin and tonic, do you want to add a little bit of lime juice? Great. You know, so that's one of those sort of dating back to, like, pre-prohibition cocktails. It was just a way of offering up a way to alter your drink, a very modest garnish. And I think that a lot of fruit garnishes still kind of fall into that. If you want to toss them in the drink, it'll add a little bit, you know, add a little bit of sweetness.
Now, the one I never understood is the celery stick in the Bloody Mary. I mean, that's just because it doesn't add any flavor, you know. It's like they call those kind of flag garnish.
Oh, well, that flag is specific. Flag is a,
right,
a wheel with a cherry of some kind.
Well, they said that one was a flag too, because it just kind of sticks up out of there and is prominent or something, but a celery stick doesn't really add any flavor, and celery doesn't really have a scent. So it's just kind of, it's just there. It's just there because it looks good, I guess.
I think that's that identifying thing that you talked about. And I also think it is one of the, well, I remember a bit of the origin story of the celery stick, where it's basically like a bartender did not have a tool on hand to stir the drink with, so he used a celery stick.
Well, that'd work.
Sure. I do think, like, it is, you use celery salt often in Bloody Mary mix, so it can play into the flavor profile. It can serve a purpose. I don't think it's that different from putting a pineapple in your pina colada, honestly.
Yeah.
but But, you know, in any, like, to the history, we get this, you know, this era of tiki cocktails. We get a lot of inedible garnishes. We get the plastic cocktail monkeys that hang on the side of your glass. We get the mermaids. We get the, like, popular swizzle stick in this time period, like the 50s and 60s. Little themed plastic sticks that'll either have, like, the name of a hotel or, you know, the, like, a little, like, cute emblem on it. But this is not an this was not originated in this time period, actually. This is, like, more history. At some point, we need to do an episode just all on swizzles because it's a whole style of cocktail. But the swizzle stick, prominent garnish in the 50s and 60s, does not originate there. It actually dates all the way back to, like, the 1600s. It was used, like, in the West Indies, like, for a specific, like, rum, sugar, lime cocktail. And it was cut from... like the allspice bush, they would get these branches that sort of had these pronged ends on them, and they would use these branches to stick in the glass and mix around with their drink, to swizzle their drink, and that specific plant earned the nickname, like, the swizzle tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then that same idea, like, in the 20s, would get popularized by, like, women that wanted to drink champagne but didn't want to be gassy, so they would put swizzle sticks in their champagne to get the bubbles out of it, as wrong as that sounds. And then in the 50s and 60s, it gets rebranded as just a cute little garnish in drinks.
Well, now, my parents, neither one of them hardly ever drank, ever, and their bar pretty much stayed the same. The same bottles were there at the same levels all the time. But I do remember... right next to that half bottle of cream de mint that I talked about before, there was a nice little holder that had swizzle sticks. And that's the only reason I know what a swizzle stick is. I remember them having those specific little swizzle sticks. And when they would serve a drink, the rare occasions when they served a drink, they would stir it with that and leave the swizzle stick in when they presented the drink.
Yeah. It was a very, I mean, it was a popular style. You know, most of mm-hmm. these... like, you know, if you were a hotel, you had a branded swizzle stick that you would put in your tall drinks. You know, mm-hmm. it was a normal thing. I came across a lot of them at a junk store a while ago. Just, they're selling just a rubber band pack of weird swizzle sticks from the 50s.
Huh.
I bought them. They were, like, you know, a couple bucks. And I don't know where they're all from, but they're fascinating artifacts to me. Because it's just, you know, each one a different color, a different little weird... emblem on them. It was kind of a cool thing. People out there collect them now, but it has a long history.
Yeah, that was my only that I've ever been exposed to them was my parents having them on their small bar cart.
Yeah, it was a stylish thing. Of course, as we get into, like, the 70s and 80s, I don't think I need to tell you this, Dad, but sort of the days, just as much as the dark days of American bartending take place, garnishes were included in that. Getting, like, a fresh lime wedge, you might get a red cherry. Not big in the garnish game, I feel mm-hmm. like, during this time period.
Well, I always felt like a garnish was just a decoration, and I usually would, first thing I'd do when somebody'd bring me a drink with a garnish is take it off and throw it on the table or whatever. Yeah. Put it on the salad plate, you know, because I just thought, well, that's in the way for me to drink it. I don't like drinking through a straw. I like drinking out of the glass, so... Mm. Now that you've educated me, I see that the garnish can enhance the drink, you know, that, you know, like the lemon peel, then you put it around the rim of the glass and you twist it and release the oils into the drink and let it float in there. Or the smells. There was something that we made one time and we put a sprig of something in it, rosemary or thyme or something like that. And you can smell that while you're doing it, you know, or when you're spanking your mint, you know. So that you can release the flavors. Yeah, yeah, spank it before you put it in there.
And, you know, like, we talked about how much, like, olfactory, like, the nose of something affects how we taste them, that, like, mm-hmm. a huge part of our palate is informed by flavor. Mm-hmm. So if you smell something, our palates are limited, our nose is pretty nuanced. So you mm-hmm. smell it and then you taste it, but it's both things. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that, like, I think, you know, as we get... into modern day bartending since the cocktail renaissance, of course, you know, Dale DeGroff, who we've talked about, one of the men responsible for bringing back cocktail culture to America, he was one of those that brought back proper garnishes, twists, you know, proper, well-made cherries, you know, appropriate garnishes. We've kind of moved beyond that into a new realm, which is weird, and sometimes it's cool, and sometimes it's fun, and sometimes it just is offensive to me. So, like, the conversation on garnishes nowadays is very different. Like, you know, it's not uncommon to encounter, I don't know, you know, an old fashioned with bacon on the side, or fried oysters, or a cocktail served with Dorito crumbs as a rim, or cookies on top. The cookies actually isn't that outlandish. We made a, what was it, Rob Roy? No, a Bobby Burns not too long ago. Bobby Burns could also be served with a shortbread cookie, so that's a little bit older. The cookie on the side, I'm all over. But you know, like, we've really kind of gotten all over the place with what counts as a garnish these days.
Yeah. I like cookies in my blizzard.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, if you have a cookie on the side and you want to dip it in, it's that old school, you know, that biscuit in the wine or the ale, the British thing or the Roman wine thing. But garnishes these days really challenge that concept of what is a garnish? At what point does it take away from a drink, and at what point is it enhancing a drink?
And what point is it just a novelty item?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best example of this is, and there have been articles written about this, I feel like I was actively bartending during the heat of this with Bloody Marys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what you mentioned, the celery stick, which, you know, I'd argue has a purpose. I'd say, yeah, celery salt can be used in Bloody Marys. It matches the flavor profile. It's not any different for me than, like, putting a lime wedge in a cocktail that has lime in it. But when you're garnishing Bloody Marys with whole sliders or fried chicken or, you know, like Reubens, I've seen so many things done to Bloody Marys.
Man, poor Bloody Mary.
Well, you know, it's like at that point, like, don't get me wrong, I love a snack with my drink, but does it have anything to do with the drink itself, or is it just for the Instagram? Is it just for the picture?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know what makes a good Bloody Mary is a ham sandwich hanging on the rim.
I have seen so many cocktails garnished with sandwiches.
I've heard of soup and sandwich, but not cocktail and sandwich.
Well, like, I don't know. Like, I was, you know, just sort of looking at lists of, like, audacious garnishes that people have put out there, and, you know, doing like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, little quarter on the side of a drink. There's a part of me that loves that. I do love whimsy. If you've seen drinks that I've made, I am absolutely guilty of putting silly things in drinks because they're fun. You know, I did a drink that was it was a pool blue sort of drink, like, with, you know, with blue curacao, and I put a rubber ducky in it, a tiny rubber ducky. And it was cute. You know, was it functional in the drink? Absolutely not. I mean, likewise, I did a like, peanut-infused, like, brown sugar old-fashioned, and I made, with the peanuts I infused into the bourbon, I then made peanut brittle with them. So it was, like, alcoholic peanut brittle, and then I put a little piece of peanut brittle on the side of the drink.
Mm-hmm.
Does that enhance the drink? I don't know. I mean, you could argue it doesn't, because you're putting something really sweet on the side of a drink where the sweetness is sort of nuanced, and is that going to blow out the drink and make it taste less sweet than it should?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guilty of some of this, but it is a lot of the conversations you hear around garnishes are like, is it in service to the drink? If it's not, then you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, I try to think about when we're doing the bespoke ones, I try to think about what fits with it that would add to it, as opposed to just putting something on it for looks.
I mean, and it's a conversation that, you know, a lot of people have. I think it even gets into the realm of how important is a visual to a drink. You know, I've known one of my first bar managers was really hardcore in the idea that every choice you make in a drink should be in service to the flavor of the drink and the flavor alone. So making choices for aesthetics, putting garnishes on that in any way are not just fully serving the drink, you shouldn't do those things. Mm-hmm. There's a whole school of thought that is that. And I mean, this is just my aesthetic, but I get a little bored when I go into a cocktail bar and every drink on the menu falls into a realm of like brownish orange to yellowish orange, and mm-hmm. it's garnished with a wheel or a twist or a wedge, and maybe a cinnamon stick. I'm a little bored.
Right.
I'm like, okay. Like, I get it. These drinks taste good, but I'm a bit more of the idea that, well, we eat with our eyes, so we... Ergo, we probably drink with our eyes too. Like, I get excited when a drink has a fun palette to it. It looks cool in the glass, you know. The garnish mm-hmm. fits it with everything. There's different schools of thought. I don't think there's a right and wrong. I think it's different schools of thought.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with adding a couple of showstoppers to the menu there so that, you know, if people want that, then that's available.
Well, I mean, in it, like an edible flower on a drink.
Mm-hmm.
Edible flowers are one of those things that, I don't know if I've ever been served a cocktail with an edible flower where I eat the flower and I'm like, yeah, this made this drink great.
But it's just the concept.
You can eat it. It's fine. Yeah. It won't kill you. But mm-hmm. it looks beautiful. If you've ever just been served a beautiful, you know, like tall, like pellet ice tiki drink with a, you know, just pink orchid on top of it, it's a beautiful presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can eat that orchid if you want to. Does it enhance the flavor? No. Does it offend the flavor? Also, no. Which I think is where I fall more. Like, I don't want to ever garnish anything with something that takes away from the drink. But if it doesn't do anything either way and it improves the visuals, I think that's okay.
And how about the glasses that have the light-up bottom in them? Is that because is light considered a garnish?
I mean, I guess it depends on how you feel about it. Yeah, I mean, in some cases, I would say that, yes, the light is a garnish. I'm thinking from the terms of, like, managing a menu, that is something that you write in the note. Garnished with this dumbass light-up glass that we have.
I can also remember drinks that glow in the dark. When we'd go to bars in Myrtle Beach when we were young, and they would go around and there would be girls in like lab coats, and they would have test tubes of these glowing drinks, selling them for $1 a shot or something like that. Yeah, we didn't know what we were drinking. You just dump it down.
I encountered this on the streets of New Orleans the last time I was down there.
Yeah,
we weren't even in a bar. We were on the street, quite. Like, literally, someone just walked up to me with a rack of test tubes.
Yeah, you look like you need a drink there.
$5, and I said, okay. I don't know. Wow. Give it anybody.
Back in my day, they were a buck. Now they're $5.
Got up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, it ultimately, I don't know. It comes down into the experience, the visuals, I do think matter. I am not in agreement with the idea that everything should be in service purely to the taste. But that's true in culinary senses as well, right? Like mm-hmm. we understand that in how we make food. It's not insane that we should imply that to drinks as well. That being said, I do think that because of this like rising bar on how extravagant can you get with your garnishes, in modern bartending, we are entering into a territory where it's like we need to not be dangerous with it, though, y'all. Like the dangerous garnishes, and I mean, I've never had anything personally, I've never caused an accident personally, but I feel like I've seen in action the fact that anything you put on a glass, no matter how much you think it looks inedible, people will try to eat it.
Well, I've heard about sparklers being put on ones too, and you don't want to get around that. Sparklers and alcohol, you never know what might happen.
Dangerous garnishes, I think, have a time and place. Fire specifically. Like, if you're working in, like, a high-end cocktail bar where everything's very controlled, everything's very low-key, maybe you can serve some fire. I think that that's a maybe. I remember working at Tiki Party years ago, and we did the little lime cup. So, you know, when you juice a lime on the machine, mm-hmm. you get this little empty cup of lime. And you can... We would fill it with 151 and light it on fire and serve that as a garnish. And there was a guy that, like, I watched the bartender put the drink down in front of him. The guy looked at it, and the guy said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's a little 151 we set on fire. It's just a garnish." And the guy said, "Sweet," and picked it up and tried to take it as a shot. It was a full cup of fire.
He didn't blow it out first?
No, he just tried to drink the fire.
Oh, man.
He didn't, like, you know, it dissipates anybody that's, like, you know... it dissipates very quickly. The man did not set his face on fire. But this moment of sheer fear of like, oh no, this is not the venue for flaming cocktails. People are drunk. People are doing whatever, mm-hmm. you know, just not the place for fire.
Yes.
I mean, I've seen like I mentioned the rubber duckies. Like they were 1 inch by 1 inch. Absolutely, people picked them up and tried to put them in their mouths. They're like, no, that's plastic.
It's not
plastic
edible. Plastic. It's not edible.
Do not eat that.
It's not a sugar duck.
Well, and, you know, there have been horror stories about, like, nothing that I've done, but I've read stories of people serving dry ice in cocktails and not realizing people will eat the dry ice. Even if you put it underneath so it, like, comes up from around, like, people consume the dry ice and get horrible burns from that.
Oh, man.
I've seen, I think it was marigolds put in a cocktail. I was on the side of a glass, but marigolds are, I believe, are poisonous. Like flowers that are not safe to consume.
Right.
Put as a garnish, and then you just don't really think through. Well, no one's going to try to eat this. Yes, someone will. That is a kitchen rule.
Yeah.
You put something on a plate. Assume that someone's going to put it in their mouth.
Sure.
Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
I've done dehydrated garnishes before, like dehydrated lime wheels. People don't try to eat regular lime wheels, but I will put a dehydrated lime wheel in a cocktail, and inevitably somebody I will look up at the bar, and someone's just gnawing on it, like maybe it's a snack. Like, it's not a snack.
not to be eaten. Put you stencil that on the side of it. Do not consume.
It's fun. Like I think you know, non-functional garnishes. I'm in the camp of no. It's fine. If it's cute, if it kind of plays into the story of a drink, I think it's fine. You just have to make sure that it can't,
that it's idiot proof,
kill anybody. Yes. There was one garnish I did that was sweet potato little chips, and they were covered in cinnamon sugar, and it was cute. It wasn't like the most delicious thing. They were handmade, and they were like little star-shaped things, so you could eat them. But we had to like make them in a way. They were meant purely as a garnish. You just had to make them a way that you knew someone was going to try to eat the little sweet potato star on the drink. And they did all the time. People ate them. Like, that's not particularly delicious. I'm like, well, it's not meant to be eaten, but it is safe to eat. So,
well, it wasn't cooked, was it?
Oh yeah. I mean, well, no, it was like a raw sweet potato. We dehydrated with the cinnamon and sugar. So it was a good aromatic vessel.
Right.
Like, dehydrated garnishes are not purely for looks. They give you good aromatics, but it just, you
know, but they're not tasty.
Make sure.
Yeah.
It was thin enough that you could eat it, and it would be a crunchy little cinnamon sugar chip. It just wasn't particularly, it wasn't fried.
So, right.
You know, it's not great.
Yeah. Take it to the fair, fry it there.
But the bigger conversation of like, should a cocktail garnish be fully functional and impart flavor to the drink? Can it just be fanciful and cute? I think in the age of Instagram, I think that purely visual elements are part of the sell.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not getting away from that anytime soon.
Well, I know that my opinion has changed, and I now embrace the garnish and use it for what it's meant for and appreciate it and try to strive to do it. I've read one that made a challenge for me. The horse neck. Are you familiar with that drink?
Oh yeah, you. It's like the whole peel you pull off, and little hook, and you. It's like it's for a tall glass. Yeah.
Yeah, and you set it down inside the glass. Yeah, the whole. You're supposed to peel the entire lemon in one piece, and then put that whole lemon peel down there. Yeah. So I'm
the horse neck comes from the fact that it's kind of the start point is a little bit of a hook, so it hooks over the edge.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a horse's head. They said.
So, you know, there's a lot of there really good books out there on garnishes. I think as long as you take safety into mind, I think you can kind of garnish with whatever you feel. Just be aware, like, as long as it doesn't impede on the flavor of your drink, I think it's okay. Or pose a danger to your patrons. I think it's fine.
Then garnish with abandon.
Yes. Some people will argue against that. Some people are very much, if it's not functional in fully to the drink, then it's worthless. That's fine too. There are some drinks the garnishes offend me, but that's only when we get into the garnish is the reason a drink is expensive, which is a whole trend actually. Like there's I don't know how long these last, but like there was a drink that was like $3,000 called the Sapphire Martini at the Boxwood Resort in Connecticut. And we're talking about a blue curacao, like sweet, not even a martini, but it comes with sapphire and diamond earrings on the side.
Well, that's just a tourist trap.
Well, or like $22,000 for a Diamond is Forever cocktail at the Ritz-Carlton in Tokyo that comes with, yes, a diamond, you know. But like, it's also like a moderate Grey Goose martini just served with diamonds. So you're not even getting any like cool liquor experience. You're just getting a diamond.
Well, we're simple folk. We're just going to stick to the vegetables and fruits and occasional spice or, you know, whatever.
There was one that the W, I don't know if they, that I doubt they still do this, but there was the W in New York did a garnish for a cocktail that they called the Nightcap, which was a room key. So they're a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So you could get a drink at their hotel bar that would come with a hotel key in the drink. That was like $300. So it was the cost of the room. You're paying for the room.
Oh, so you got a room.
I'm kind of like on the fence about that because I've definitely been at hotel bars where it's like, man, I just kind of want to go to sleep now. And if there was a way that I could just be like, yeah, actually, no, I'm going to stay here for the night. Give me that drink. Take it to my room. That's all right.
Oh, man.
So there you go.
Well, all right.
Brief history of cocktail garnishes. Garnish at your own risk.
And pleasure.
People will put anything in their mouth. Just don't ever forget that. If it's on your, you want those little safety pins that are so cute to hang a little flower on the side of a glass, someone's going to try to eat the safety pin. I've seen it happen.
So don't use those. Only edible stuff.
I mean, or you know, just roll the dice. Put dice in it. Someone will put it in their mouth.
Well, all right.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Dad, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. I got to learn all about garnishes I didn't know about.
And if you want to support us, you can do that. We have a Patreon. Our lovely patrons are the reason this happens, so thank you all. You can check us out over there. You get rewards as well if you join. The bespoke cocktails we mentioned earlier, if you want to know more about that, well, you got to join to figure that out. If you want to find us on social media, we are NeedTheBoozeCast on Twitter and Instagram, and NeedTheBoozeCast@gmail.com. If you want to email us your questions, and of course, if you're one of our patrons, you should just message us your questions, because we always give those priority. In fact, that's what this was. If you want to talk about your garnish game, you can do that
at NeedTheBoozeCast group page on Facebook.
All right. Well, hey, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
Neat.
Well, I guess if you had a mint julep and you wanted to add more mint to it, I guess that's what you'd call an augment.
Commitment to the bit there, Dad.
Commitment?
Commitment. Mint was already the word.